Hello, everybody. I'm Chris Garcia, and I have the distinct honor, privilege, and pleasure to interview Mr. James Blaylock, everyone. So we're going to do a little bit of this interview here, and then we're going to open it up for questions to all of you, because I know you have hundreds of questions that are better than mine. So let's start just really simple.
Can I say something before we start?
Absolutely.
You can see this being podcast. It struck me that if we were squids, it would be a pseudopodcast, which is, I can't be the first one to have thought of that hilarious joke. So anyway, I thought we'd get off.
Or it could be a cephalopodcast.
Cephalopodcast.
Yeah. Because then, you know, with the tentacles and, oh, doom. Yes. Oh, sorry.
Oh, yeah. I had it wrong. A pseudopod is a one-footed creature. Or maybe a two.
A false-footed creature.
False-footed. Okay.
Yes. The amoebas. We are way off on tangent already. This is amazing. Okay, so James Blaylock is one of my personal favorite authors. One of the three people named at the in the famous letter about where about the name steampunk came from. So we're going to talk about that. But first, let's delve deep.
All right.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Anaheim, California. Wonderful place down south.
Mm-hmm. So Orange County born and bred?
Orange County. Well, I was born in Long Beach, California, which is across the border. But yeah, grew up in, I've lived in Orange County most of my life. Yeah.
Wow. And most of your characters have lived in Orange County, as I've noticed.
Yeah, I got to a point where it seemed like I should write about things close to home mm-hmm. a certain amount.
Yeah, one of my favorite films that deals with sort of the Orange County experience is called Orange County, Jack Black. And it's a kid who wants to be a writer, and he's writing about living in Orange County, and everyone seems to go, why are you writing about Orange County?
Yeah, you have to actually have lived there long enough to know what Orange County is really about under the surface, you know?
Oh.
Yeah. What you see on the TV is not the thing.
Oh. Yeah. We'll have more on that, I'm
sure.
So let's go ahead. As a kid, were you a huge reader as a kid?
A huge reader, yeah.
What were you reading back then?
You know, I can't remember what I was reading before I was 8 or 9 years old, but I've still got a collection of the complete short stories of Mark Twain with my the date in it that I was given by my aunt and uncle for my birthday. I think I was 10. And at that time, I was reading Twain and Steinbeck pretty heavily.
Wow.
Looting my mother's library. I remember I read Ivanhoe, didn't get a lot out of it. Read Mrs. Astor's Horse, which was weirder than any science fiction for a 10-year-old boy living in Orange County.
Mm-hmm.
Sherlock Holmes from a very early age. My mother had a lot of books. And also she would haul me to the Stanton Library every Tuesday afternoon, and I'd grab Edgar Rice Burroughs and Howard Pease and Walter Farley.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know one of the things that sort of, you know, I think gets overlooked is the influence of Twain on the writers of the 20th century, the fabulous, as it were, that I don't think he really gets the credit that he deserves because, you know, you ask anyone, you ask Tim Powers, you ask your invention, Mr. Jeter, any of those guys, and they'll all mention Twain very heavily.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, when I was 10, Twain was great. Let's say Huckleberry Finn was great because it was an adventure book. I don't know that I understood how funny it was until I was a little bit older. And then at the university, I was supposed to get excited about symbolism and other things like that, which I kind of pitched out later on. I just read it for the funny aspect again and the adventure aspect.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Okay, we've whipped through the early years. See how easy that was? Now, when did you start actually starting to write? Were you a kid? Were you doing like your own stories and stuff? Or
yeah, the first one I remember, I was in fifth grade, which is, what is fifth grade? 11?
Yeah.
10? And I got the idea that I would write a story when I was talking to a friend of mine who had seen a film called Macabre, which, you know, most of us remember. Mm-hmm. I had never seen it. I thought it was spelled M-C, capital C-O-B. And, I had spelled weirder than that, but I didn't know it at the time. And so I wrote a story about a walking skeleton in a top hat that smoked a corncob pipe and terrorized a family in a farmhouse.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And he had no motivation, except skeletons don't need motivation. They just do what they please, you know, so it worked out pretty well.
Oh, that's excellent.
Call it Macabre.
Macabre, that's, wow. I now want to read that.
I remember it being really, really good, but that was, you know, I haven't seen it in 50 years, so I could be wrong.
Excellent. Okay, so let's go. Where'd you end up going to college?
I went to Cal State University Fullerton. Mm-hmm. For 6 years, actually, I got my BA in literature. I double majored in lit and psychology, and then I hung on for a MA in literature.
Okay. And was it there that you met Philip K. Dick?
Yeah, basically, it was there that I met Tim Powers. Mm-hmm. And Tim was hanging out with Phil Dick. And then I guess right after I graduated, I met Phil.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you don't know how amazing it is to be able to say to someone, so when did you meet Philip K. Dick? I mean, that just, to me, is just mind-blowing. Now, what was sort of, was he actually your mentor? I've seen that mentioned some places.
No, actually, I see that mentioned also, but it was remarkably seldom that we actually talked about books or writing or anything like mm-hmm. that. We were as likely to talk about rock and roll or cats or cars, everybody's car being kind of a broken down piece of junk in those days. Very rarely about, we talked about books from time to time, mm-hmm. but rarely about writing. I will say that when I wrote my first novel, The Elfin Ship, Phil and Tim and I all had, well, Phil and Tim had the same editor, Judy Lynn Del Rey at Del Rey Books, mm-hmm. and Phil wrote a really gorgeous letter for me to send along when I sent in The Elfin Ship, and part of it is, it's been excerpted on covers of my books ever since, so that was pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, that's like sort of getting the stamp of Moses.
Absolutely, yeah, and I knew it at the time. I was pretty stoked.
I like it. Now, when did you meet Tim Powers?
Tim Powers, I guess right before I went into graduate school. So let's call it 1972, okay. I guess, something like that.
Uh-huh. Okay, yeah. And so now I read something about an early novel that you sort of revived later.
Yeah, my first novel, which when I finally put it away, was probably 90 or 100,000 words handwritten on lined notebook paper. And it later on became The Digging Leviathan.
Oh, okay.
When I first started to write it, I had no idea of plot. And it was very episodic. I'd read Tristram Shandy, probably the single funniest book ever written in the English language, and decided that it was time somebody did something like that again, which was good practice. Mm-hmm. I suppose. But the plot kept opening out and out and out until it was so wide open that it would have been impossible ever to close it back up again. And when that finally revealed itself to me, I put it in the drawer. Mm-hmm. And then years later, several years later, there was an incident of a guy in Long Beach, where I was born. I was very proud of this, my hometown, who strapped or tied a bunch of helium balloons to a lawn chair. Mm-hmm. It's kind of become infamous now. And floated up, I think, 10 or 11,000 feet in the air. He was being passed by jets, and people were pointing, and it was wonderful. And he had milk cartons full of sand, as you know, and he'd empty out a little bit of sand. And finally, he landed and was arrested. And the only thing they could think of to charge him for was failing to file a flight plan, which I thought was really wonderful, you know. And he was in all the newspapers. He was horribly sunburned. That was sunscreen. And I was so wildly motivated to write again that I got the idea that I could rewrite that early novel and use a scene of a guy who floats up on helium balloons. But then as soon as I started writing, I realized that that was simply a sort of muse. Mm-hmm. And I pitched it out and wrote The Digging Leviathan.
Oh, excellent. Yeah. And we'll talk more about that in a bit.
All right.
So let's now go to sort of how many novels did you actually write before you actually published one?
I wrote – that was the only one I actually wrote. Mm-hmm. I was going to say 50% of, but I don't – I might have written that 1% of it. I have no idea. after that, in those days we didn't know it, but it was a very lovely time to be a writer. You could actually sell books on the basis of a portion and outline, two chapters and an outline. And publishers would send you real money, half your advance. Wow. And then you write the book and send it in. If it was no good, they expected you to pay the first half back, but it was already spent, so it didn't matter. so I got the idea that that I would do that. I would write some portions and outlines. And I think I wrote maybe four, five, six portions and outlines, mm-hmm. none of which sold. My favorite was a thing that I wrote for Roger Elwood, an old science fiction editor who had come up with the idea that that he would publish books about the return of King Arthur. The world would be in trouble. England would be in trouble, and Arthur would return, and Merlin would return, and all these old boys would return. So I had the idea of writing a book involving George III, who has gone crazy because he was being fed poisoned snuff. He's given poisoned snuff. And it was going to star William Blake and I don't know who all. And I got a great rejection letter back from Roger Elwood, who accused me of trying to make a joke of his project. Which I wasn't trying to make a joke of his project. I love the idea of William Blake and poisoned snuff and et cetera, et cetera. But I did things along those lines, which had really no hope of finding a home, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And then I set out to write The Elfin Ship entirely for fun. I guess I was inspired by The Wind in the Willows, mainly, Huckleberry Finn to a degree, and wrote it entirely as a lark. And by that time, Tim had sold The Drawing of the Dark, which was also written for Roger Elwood originally. Really? Lester Del Rey made him expand it into The Drawing of the Dark. Roger Elwood's series didn't last too long. So because Judy Lynn Del Rey was Tim's editor, I sent the manuscript to her. And Roger Elwood sent it back, actually, or not Roger Elwood, excuse me. Julian's husband, Lester Del Rey, actually read it and sent it back and said, gee, you're a real good writer, but you can't plot at all. And so I thought, well, that does it. I'll send it off to another editor who might be fooled into thinking that I could plot. But Tim said, no, this is a test. You have to write a letter back to Lester Del Rey and say, gee whiz, if you think I can write well enough, tell me how to plot this better and I'll write the book. And I did. And Lester sent me a contract, which was really very nice. So
yes, Lester had a lot of quirks, as I remember.
He had some quirks. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Most. Yeah. We're in a time where our editors don't have nearly the quirks they did in the '70s and eighties.
Yeah. He would send not just rejection letters, but if you send him something that he didn't quite like the look of, he would blast you with a 2 or 3 page letter, which was kind of like the Harry Potter screaming owl letters that those letters that you get. It was just like that. You'd open it up and your hair would light on fire. one time I intended to write the Digging Leviathan. It came into my mind how to make that book work. Mm-hmm. And I had sold two books to Del Rey Books, The Disappearing Dwarf and The Elfin Ship. And I called Lester on the phone. I said, hey, I've got a hot idea for a third book. And I described it to him. And he responded by saying, you went to the same goddamn university Powers did, didn't you? I thought, well, okay, this doesn't sound well right now. And he told me that, as far as he could see, it was a cultistic piece of crap that I had intended to write. And he would have nothing to do with it. He wouldn't even read it. And I thought, cultistic? I'd never heard that word before. It kind of had an appeal to me. later on, it turns out that if you're a cultistic writer, you've got an audience of about 8 people whose eyes whirl like pinwheels. I sold The Digging Leviathan to Ace Books, which turned out to be a good thing for me to do, at about the same time that Tim sold The Anubis Gates, I believe it was, mm-hmm. to Ace Books.
Yep.
And there was an ABA convention in Orange County, and Lester and Judy Lynn flew out, and Vicky and I and Tim and Serena Powers picked them up to go out to lunch. They're absolutely great folks. And we were sitting around the table at lunch, and the first thing Lester said was, I'm certainly happy that you and Tim have found a publisher for your inferior books. He's just full of that stuff. But you had to like him, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I don't know if I ever met him, but I've heard many stories from many writers about him over the years.
It was wild. And Judy Lynn was actually tougher than he was.
Really?
Yeah. When they did a good cop, bad cop thing, she was the bad cop. Yeah.
Wow, I'm now terrified of her. Yes. Okay, so let's get back to another question about The Elven Ship. Okay. Now, that is one that actually I believe you open with a quote from The Wind in the Willows.
Yeah.
And I mean, was that a conscious sort of, was that a world that, you know, you sort of wanted to work in? Was this sort of fantastic but elven instead of animal?
Yeah, I would say so. Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, yeah. I still do. I in fact, very much like the whimsical, lyrical aspects of, and funny aspects of The Wind in the Willows. And I kind of wanted to do that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
By that time, I'd read a lot of the Ballantine adult fantasy series, and I'd read, of course, The Lord of the Rings, and I that's something I really did not want to do. Not that I didn't love it, but I was just afraid I didn't want to get into that territory. You know, yeah. I wanted to kind of go my own way. And The Wind in the Willows had more the vibe that I was looking for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sort of. It seemed like at that point there were a lot of people who were going with that. You know, the fantastic hero's quest of, you know, the massive, and then there's these little characters on the side. It's almost as if you wanted to focus on the those little side characters.
Very much.
And I remember I read it when I was 17, probably.
Okay.
And it was one of my favorite novels. That was in print for a long time, if I remember correctly.
It was in print for 11 or 12 years, yeah.
Yeah. And that for modern day is like having a website that's been up since the 1840s.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. And then The Disappearing Dwarf, I don't remember much of. I know I read it because I have a dog-eared copy that I must have read two or three times back. But what was going on there?
Well, I had always thought that that I would write three of those books, trilogies being a big deal at the time. Now I think it's decalogies. I don't know, but Lester made it very clear to me that he would not consider any book that required a sequel. He said, if the book wants a sequel, I'll know when I, you know, finish it. So the first book had to be a standalone novel. But there are always ends loose enough to fabricate a sequel if you want to fabricate one. And it was sort of a fabricated sequel, very much in the same vein. Could be the characters were slightly funnier in the second book. I'm not quite sure. Then I had in mind to do a third, and Lester convinced me that the third would come by and by, but why didn't I do a prequel first? And so I wrote the prequel, and it went off to the Del Reys, and they weren't doing too well. Their health wasn't too good in those days, and one thing led to another, and both of them passed away. And so the book, after years of kind of being in limbo, was sold to Ace and came out as the Stone Giant a good long time after the first two came out. Long enough so that I had gone on to other things, and then in the sequel that I had intended to write in those days to The Disappearing Dwarf just was never written.
Now, here's sort of going back to, I love to ask questions about what were you reading when, but a lot of your early work really has sort of that a feel of the English authors of the late 19th, early 20th. And there is, I think, and maybe I, now having heard you mention at some point when we were talking at WindyCon about P.G. Wodehouse, and when I was going through a lot of the earlier stuff of yours that we're doing, I was noticing Wodehousian moments, and just, you know, there was sort of that feel. Like, what sort of the English authors were influencing you?
Well, I think when I was a literature major, I was crazy mostly for English lit. And aside from Tristram Shandy, which was written in the 18th century, I was probably craziest for Dickens and everything post-Dickens up through the Edwardians.
Mm-hmm.
The moderns I read for pleasure, but not, they had no influence on me, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I was, in the days that I was writing my first books, I was probably crazy for Dickens, Stevenson, and then P.G. Wodehouse. Mm-hmm. On the side,
yeah.
And in my early work, I can look at any chapter and kind of recall which of those writers I'm gonna say inspired. I was inspired by at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think though that by the time I was publishing, a couple of years down the line, the outright effect of those authors faded just a little bit, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And it's they're a little bit harder to distinguish now.
Right. Yeah. Well, I think definitely the works that we would consider yours to be steampunk definitely have a Stevenson feel to them.
Yes.
And I mean, and what a great segue. So let's actually start working with the sort of steampunk. So you had you and Powers and Jeter are sort of the three that are always pointed out to as being the, you know, the founders of the modern steampunk movement. Were you aware of like the Moorcock stuff that had been?
No.
I mean, no, really?
No.
Oh, wow.
No, in fact, I was unaware of, entirely unaware of it until about a year ago, I suppose.
Really?
Yeah, and I still haven't read the Moorcock book or books. Mm-hmm. I plan to someday. I understand they're good, but I, you know, just haven't.
I haven't read them either, but I like to say I have. Let me ask you about sort of the, were you specifically sort of pulling from Wells and Verne and sort of?
I was hugely influenced, especially by Verne, who was perhaps more colorful in certain ways than Wells. But I was a crazy for the Time Machine and heaps of Wells. I even at one time read Mr. Britling Sees It Through, only because I thought the title sounded pretty cool. Title was kind of cooler than the book in many ways. I think Stevenson was the big inspiration at the time, though. And in fact, I'll cop to this. My very first steampunk story was a thing called The Ape Box Affair that was published in Unearth magazine in, I'm going to say, 76, although I always kind of forget. So it was fairly early. And I'm going to say that it was the first American steampunk piece, if in fact steampunk was something that we can associate with K.W. Jeter and Tim Powers and me. Mm-hmm. After that, of course, K.W. published More Like Night, or Night, as a one of the laser books, I think. And Tim later on came out with the Anubis Gates. And I came out with Homunculus, and we kind of went round and round. K.W. wrote a good one with Infernal Devices.
Yeah, Infernal Devices is one of my personal favorites.
It was a fun book.
Oh, yeah. It's chew-worthy. It is worthy of just eating that thing up two or three times. Yeah. It's fantastic.
I had just to answer your question about where this stuff came from, I cribbed some stuff from Stevenson's novel, The Dynamiter, which I'm going to insist nobody's read but me, at least in the last 75 or 80 years, which had to do with boxes being mixed up, one of which I believe was an infernal device. And I thought, I like mixed up boxes. So I did mixed up boxes in The Eight Box Affair. Mm-hmm. And then it became sort of central to Homunculus also, because I wanted to give a kind of a bigger treatment. Mm-hmm. So that was, both of those are very Stevensonian.
Oh, yeah. I mean, sort of like, you know, I find myself reading an author and then going to another one, and it's usually, you know, I read Lord Kelvin's Machine, which is one of my favorite adventure novels in the entire history of human existence.
Wow.
And just, you know, and that led me to, it led me to Stevenson, and led me, oddly enough, to Sherlock Holmes again, because I sort of, there's sort of a strange sort of Holmesian quality to Langdon St. Ives.
Oh, and that's on purpose, too. I love the foggy Gothic atmosphere, and as most people do, I think.
Oh, yeah.
And I really wanted to capture that. But that same atmosphere is common to parts of Jekyll and Hyde, also. Mm-hmm. I think, which was a big influence at the time.
Oh yeah. Yeah, Jekyll and Hyde is one of those stories I think that gets sort of pushed to the side in favor of sort of the other works that, you know, sort of have eclipsed it a bit.
Yeah.
But everyone wants to reimagine it. Right. But no one wants to return to the actual text, I think.
Yes. Yeah. And the reimaginings are never very good, I hate to say.
No.
Yeah.
No, the BBC one, Jekyll, was particularly bile-inducing.
Oh.
Yeah. Awful. By the way, did you see the Sherlock Holmes movie that came out recently?
I did see it, and I quite enjoyed it.
Ah, thank you.
Yeah.
That makes me happy to hear.
Yeah. Well, I had been warned that if I went in, just looking to have fun, I would have fun. And I did, and I did.
Yeah. So let's talk about Langdon St. Ives as a character.
Okay.
So there was sort of let's say you're sitting down to write Langdon St. Ives, and what's going through your head?
Probably that I desperately need to rearrange my paper clips and things on the desktop and get a sandwich, whatever will put off the process, you know, of writing. No, but seriously. You know, I think I had in mind a mood and a setting more than I had in mind a character. And in fact, several of the characters that I, two of the characters that I did have in mind, I had cribbed outright from Stevenson's New Arabian Nights, which is something that people also don't read, although they should. And I thought, well, Stevenson's dead. He can't sue me. So I'll steal a couple of his characters and put them into London, you know, in a, into my book. And yeah, I don't know. I just had this feel. I needed a scientist who could go on any variety of adventure, more of an explorer, I suppose, than a scientist. But, you know, who could build a spaceship in the garage if it was necessary, or in the barn. Yeah, I was pretty heavily influenced by Out of the Silent Planet. I love the idea of tinkerers in the backyard putting together spacecraft that would have plants on board to, you know, provide oxygen and that sort of thing. So you'd kind of fly off in a floating greenhouse. And in fact, that's about as close to science as I can come today still. I had whatever science Langdon St. Ives had in him had to be invented science, because mm-hmm. I don't know any science. No.
And that seems to work better in a fictional world than in the real world, where it happens as well.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, I had a misadventure as a high school student. I was in a physics class. I'm not really cut out for physics, but I was in a physics class. My teacher was talking about mass. And I had it in my mind that mass simply meant something was very large. And it turns out that that isn't a good definition of mass if you're in a physics class. But and he revealed that as a spacecraft is hurtling toward light speed, that it would become infinitely massive. And I still might have this wrong. But I pictured an astronaut in the spacecraft. It probably looked like something out of the Far Side cartoon, shooting along through space, getting larger and larger and larger until the spaceship was just completely filled up by this enormous balloon-like guy, you know, looking out through a faceplate. I remember I didn't actually bring that up in class because I was a little bit too afraid to, but I remember my definition of mass on a test. My teacher had some comments that were about along the line of Lester Del Rey's, actually. It was years before I could use that idea in a book. Every goofy thing I come up with, I generally manage to give it to one of my characters sooner or later. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And now, I love the quote you gave yesterday about plesiosaurs.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought that was... let's have it so it's officially recorded on recording.
Well, not too long back, I got interested in plesiosaurs for reasons I don't have any idea why I got interested in them. So I started looking around to see when they've been sighted, I suppose, in the last 100 years. And it does turn out that there were numerous sightings all the way up into maybe the 1930s, I would say. Perfectly reasonable people and groups of people simply saw them swimming along here, there, and the other place, you know, around the globe. They were reported on, the sort of thing Charles Fort would have been crazy about, I suppose. But then all of a sudden, aside from Loch Ness and maybe a couple of lakes up in Canada, they became more and more rare, which made me wonder why. You know, what did they all, like, leave or something like that? Quit showing up? They're all hiding now someplace?
They've gone underground, like the Masons.
Yeah. But I, you know, I think yesterday when I was talking about that, I said that that one of the things that attracts me to science at the turn of the last century, or to Victorian science, was that it was still quite possible that somewhere in, you know, the wilds of Africa or something, there were mm-hmm. plesiosaurs sporting in a duck pond, you know, among with the hippos, and yeah, and that's a world I've always kind of wanted to live in. Back when you could buy, you know, beachfront property on Mars, you know, along a canal or something. And now we can't. You know, now Mars is just a barren... Now we're wondering whether or not there's ice crystals. I'm not interested in ice crystals. You know, I want a canal.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Now, I just wanted to make sure I got that story out and it came to my mind. Now, you have... I like to look at St. Ives and Orbando
okay.
as Holmes and Moriarty.
Okay.
And, I mean, that sort of... the evil character, who I guess, is it fair to say is completely evil?
I think so. I haven't found any redeeming qualities in him yet. Although that's an interesting thing to explore.
Yeah, actually, because I've always just, you know, my picture of the Victorian madman is Norbano. Uh-huh. And like, And that scene at the end of Lord Kelvin's Machine, it just, you know, it's the falls to me. Oh. And I love that moment. And you know, talk a little bit about Norbando as, you know, you are writing a character without any redeeming qualities that you found.
Well, yeah, I kind of wanted a villain, a Moriarty-type villain. And in fact, the downside of the Moriarty-type villain is that Moriarty simply never shows up. So we have to sort of take it on faith that he's the mover and shaker that people say he is. Also, one time I read a novel by Balzac that doesn't get read too often either. I think a novel called The 13, in which the major premise is that there are 13 guys who are sort of movers and shakers. I think they're living in Paris in Balzac's novel. Mm-hmm. Control the workings of the world, which has always been both amusing to me and kind of fun. And in fact, for years, every novel I'd start to write, I'd title it The 13, with the idea that if I couldn't really find enough plot to make the novel work, I'd haul in these 13 guys, you know, and put them in there somehow. But I kind of conceived Norbando as being one of those 13 guys. And I stole his name, by the way, from a Borges story, a short story by Borges, yeah. I thought that would be safe.
Yeah, good call.
I love the name, you know, Dr. Norbando. In the novel Lord Kelvin's Machine, there's a point where my hero decides to go back in the past to, he has a time machine, he goes back in the past to see what Norbando's up to as a child, discovers that he's got some fairly big troubles and will, and I had my hero actually fly to the future to get some penicillin, take it back so that Norbando's medical problems could be cleared up, et cetera, in an effort to sort of save him from turning into the monster that he would ultimately turn into. That seemed like a kind of a... That was as close as I came to trying to humanize Norbando. But I like him better as an inhuman monster than somebody who is redeemed,
yeah.
You know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it certainly hooks your readers, for sure. Now, we've made it 32 minutes into this interview.
Great.
Without me mentioning William Ashbless.
Okay.
And this, I think, deserves me a round of applause for my restraint. So let's see. Now, where did Ashbless come from?
Ashbless popped up back in when Tim Powers and I were both going to Cal State Fullerton. We had a terrible habit back in those days of not going to class too often. and in fact, Powers was famous for having attended his History of Modern English, History of the English Language, I guess, twice after the opening day and getting an A in the class, which it was possible for him to do. So we sat around the student union and were feeling guilty one day that we weren't doing anything, I don't know, intellectual. And so Tim took a piece of paper and wrote a sentence on it, and I followed it with another sentence, and we went back and forth and produced what we like to think of as poetry. and we decided that the poet would be named William Ashbless and that we would submit the poetry to the school newspaper, which was partly a sort of literary rag. It was publishing some poetry in those days. And in fact, this whole thing was spawned when I believe it was Tim who was reading the poetry with disgust and said, we can write worse poetry than this. it was a challenge. So we had the idea that when we wrote these poems, if the poem took any direction at all, if it came into focus at all, we would immediately change the direction, change the focus, so that it was impossible actually ever to say what the poetry was about. And also that we would sprinkle it with literary and historical allusions as often as we could so that it would sound as if it was erudite. Mm-hmm. And so we spent just hours doing this. We managed to, in fact, the newspaper published everything that we gave them. My wife and I were living down the street from the school one night, and the telephone rang, and we had been very careful to imply that there actually was a William Ashbless, but that there was something hideously wrong with him. He was a student, but you never see him because he had these proxies who went to class and all, because he was so hideously wrong in some sense. It was never defined exactly how. So we got a phone call, and it was somebody from the newspaper asking to speak to William Ashbless, and so I chatted with him for a while and said, made sure that everything I said was as crazy as I could conceivably make it. And that went on for a while. It finally got a little bit tiring, and so we decided to push the envelope just a little bit and to write a sort of T.S. Eliot-esque poem to tell him what the whooping crane said. We called it Life on the Farm. And that killed it. We sent that in, and there was stony silence from the other end from that point on. They never published any more of our stuff. But that, at that time, that was funnier to us than if they had gone on publishing the stuff. He became very prolific, though. He wrote literally hundreds of poems. In fact, one afternoon, I remember, he wrote 49 poems in a period of about an hour and a half.
And then he goes on to live in, he's in the Anubis Gates, he's all over the place.
Yeah, at that time, we were both writing these sorts of wild books, and we always put a old craggy, shaggy poet in there somehow. I always had William Blake in mind because he was always one of my favorite literary characters. Powers wrote the Anubis Gates and mailed it off, and I wrote the Digging Leviathan and mailed it off, both to Beth Meacham at Tor. And she called me on the telephone. She said, "You know, you got a character in your book that's named the same thing as one of Powers' characters." And immediately I knew what had happened, you know, because, and I said, "I'll change the name of mine." And she said, "No, it's the same guy." I said, "Really?" And then I started thinking about it. And I thought, you know, it probably is the same guy. And it turned out that, you know, he had simply bounced into the future and that he was semi-immortal for some reason, having to do with elixir made from carp glands. And then he became a more prominent character in my Langdon St. Ives novels also, because mm-hmm. I figured if Powers had put him back in the 19th century that, you know.
Exactly.
Right. After a while, though, we sort of didn't, I don't know, William Ashbless wouldn't fit into every novel, that's all I can say. He might mm-hmm. show up again in somebody's novel, it's hard to say. He's out there. He actually now lives in Long Beach, California. Oh. In a bad apartment near a restaurant called Egg Heaven. And every once in a while, he's been dead four times. And then he always comes back and accuses Powers and I of having stolen his poetry. And every once in a while, he drives over and beats us up. And in fact, I got a call from, I think it was BossCon years ago. Tim was going to be the guest of honor there. And they called and asked if William Ashbless could write a bio. And I said, sure. So Ashbless wrote the bio, just saying terrible things about Tim. I thought it was all pretty funny. I was chortling, and I mailed it off. And it was very interesting because people asked him, are you going to sue this son of a bitch? Gee whiz, you know, saying these terrible things. And Tim said, one of these days, I am going to sue that guy. So we've had a lot of fun with him over the years. He wrote a cookbook that Subterranean Press brought out to vast acclaim, or at least some kind of acclaim.
Some kind of acclaim. yes, I know. I sort of, every time I picture William Ashbless, I'm actually picturing the back of the book cover to Venus on the Half Shell, the supposed Theodore Sturgeon, and just take off the glasses and the rebel hat. And he's roughly the same guy.
Right.
Okay, awesome. I got to ask him about Ashbless. That makes me happy. Okay, so let's go sort of to your, let's say, phasing out of sort of the steampunk period. Sort of what sort of, when did you stop sort of looking in that direction?
You know, I can't remember the date that that Lord Kelvin's Machine, the novel, was actually published. I'd written the novella, mm-hmm. which had come out in FNSF. And, boy, you know, I think a year and a half went by. And then I wrote another novella that was basically related to the first one, kind of a sequel. and Asimov had published it, excuse me, and Gardner Dozois said, gee, a year and a half later for a sequel, and it's a novella, and novellas are hard to publish in the first place. And he said, maybe not. And then it came into my mind that actually it wasn't so much a sequel as part of the same story, and so I wrote a third section and an epilogue and a prologue and a in-between log and all sorts of other logs, and it came out as a novel. And that was in the 1990s. That was the last, for another, I'd say for 15 years after that, I didn't write any steampunk at all.
Mm-hmm.
Always intended to, I suppose. And then Bill Schaefer at Subterranean Press began to bug me for a steampunk story, and because he was fond of them and wanted to bring out a collection called The Adventures of Lane and St. Ives that would include all of them, which he did. Absolutely gorgeous book, illustrated by J.K. Potter. And putting that together, I suppose, inspired me to write more. And so I wrote a short novel called The Ebb Tide, title stolen from Robert Louis Stevenson. Thank you very much. And I'm just about wrapped up another of about the same length for Subterranean Press. And now I'm having a great deal of fun with it.
Excellent.
I find that that I, you know, enjoyed writing it then, and I enjoy writing it now equally.
Yeah. Oh, cool. That made my weekend right there. So so let's go to sort of your lady. You and Power sort of have that same sort of arc where there was a steampunk work and you had more, certainly, than Tim, and sort of go to this more urban fantasy. And the book that I just read and was blown away by was The Last Coin.
Yes.
And yes, Randy Smith approves. And sort of, I can sort of see that. I've noted that you said it was one of your favorite novels also.
Yes, it was. It was. And it it followed, I think after Homunculus came out, I finished up around that time the third Elfin Ship book, which, as I say, kind of went into limbo for a while. And I wrote a thing called Land of Dreams, set in Northern California. And then I decided that I wanted to write a contemporary novel set in Orange County. And my wife and I had always toyed with the idea of whether or not it would be fun to own a bed and breakfast restaurant someplace. Mm-hmm. The answer, I think, is no, it would not have been fun to do. So I thought, well, I'll just have that sort of central to the book. And I decided to set it in Seal Beach, California, which is up the road from where we live. And The Last Coin came out. It was vaguely related in type, I guess, to, I think, to the Digging Leviathan. In fact, there's even references to characters common to both, which is a fun thing to do. And I got the idea that if I didn't really know how to open a B&B, how to run a restaurant, kitchen, that sort of thing, my character wouldn't either. And in fact, I don't think that I actually came up with this idea, but I thought, boy, if you have a character who's really naive of how to do something, you simply have him do that thing anyway, but make him kind of a bumbler at it so that, you know, it develops some plausibility and everything will be fine. Mm-hmm. But that was... made a big difference, I suppose, in my career. That book, it was the first of my books that was got wider distribution, I suppose, and get very nice reviews. I was quite happy with that one.
Oh, excellent! Yes, yeah. It's one of those ones that's sitting on the bookshelf, staring at me for, and I had to get to it, and it was just like, I'm so glad I did.
Right, that was actually one that started out titled The 13.
Oh, really?
Yep.
You know what? That makes, honestly, now it all makes sense.
I think I was halfway through it before I decided that it had nothing to do with 13. And I had to, it was fun to figure out what, I knew I had coins in there that were somehow significant. But it took about 6 months, I guess, for me to figure out what the book was actually about. That actually involved the 30 pieces of silver. And who it was going to involve, et cetera, et cetera. That book took me a couple of years to write, as opposed to the, let's say, 8 months I'd been spending on earlier books.
Oh, wow. Yes. And it opens, like all good books should, in Ben-Gurion Airport, which makes me happy.
Yeah.
And also, there's actually a section in it that, this may surprise you, actually, that basically encapsulates why people collect things.
I think it doesn't surprise me. I think I was being a kind of a closet collector myself. If I if I really let myself go to seed, I'd collect salt and pepper shakers and paperweights and God knows what, all kinds of stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the demons in me, you know?
Yeah, but the section of the description of the spoon and the whole everything they latch onto it in that conversation just is, you know, I'm going through it, it's like, it's me and baseball cards.
Yeah, there you go.
It's me and comic books. It's like,
Actually, that spoon exists.
Really?
In the book, one of the 30 pieces of silver that I guess I can give this away. The book was written 20 years ago. had been hammered into – one of the pieces of silver had been hammered into a spoon. My father used to, in fact, make jewelry out of coins in a ball-peen hammer. And he used to make rings. I thought, why not a spoon? So my main character has – the last of these 30 coins, which are being collected by my nefarious bad man to accomplish some vile thing. He's got one of the spoons in a sort of spooner in the cupboard, and he doesn't know what it is. The idea came to me when my aged aunt, Aunt Nelvina, she was in her 90s. Her husband was a couple of years older, which means he was in his 90s also. They came over for dinner one night from Leisure World in Seal Beach, and she said, I want to give you this spoon, and she gave me this very, very thin, obviously hand-hammered spoon that had a little tear in the business end of the spoon, and she said that tear right there was made by the tooth of a pig, a giant pig, and I said, really? All of a sudden, I'm vitally interested in this spoon, which I, to tell you the truth, was not vitally interested in before that. And she said that back in 1914, the 10 kids in the family, they were in the kitchen on the family farm in Iowa, and there was this rattling on the back stoop, and my grandmother opened the door, and all the kids were behind her looking out the door, and there was an enormous pig, big as this table, I imagine, maybe bigger, I don't know, on the back stoop with the spoon in its teeth. And my grandmother reached out and took the spoon, and this is true. I confirmed it with other aunts because I was a little doubtful myself. And she took the spoon, and the pig turned around and ran off and was never seen again. And the spoon had been given to my aunt, and my aunt had put it with her stuff, and she was old, and she was giving away stuff, and she decided that, for reasons I can't understand, it would be just the sort of thing that her nephew Jim would like, and she was very correct. So I put the spoon in the china cabinet, and the next day I was talking to Powers on the phone, and I said, I got this great spoon, and here's the story behind it. And as often happened in those days, there was this dead silence on the line that went on for quite a while, and then he said, where'd you put it? And I said, I put it in the china cabinet. And he goes, keep it handy. And I said, why? And he said, because on some dark, foggy night, that pig's going to be on your front porch, and he's going to want that spoon. And I thought, of course, you know. And so I started thinking about what the spoon was and the little indentations from the ball-peen hammer reminded me of the jewelry my dad used to make, and I thought, okay, this was actually pounded out of a coin. What coin, et cetera, one thing led to another. But the spoon part is one of the elements of that book that's authentic.
Wow. That's like the best story I could have ever imagined getting for this.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah.
So now this is the part where I didn't get that far in my reading, sadly. What have you been doing lately?
Well, after The Last Coin, I wrote several more contemporary novels set largely in Southern California. Some of them had ghost elements. Several of them were moderately serious, I guess, not quite as light as even as The Last Coin, which had its humorous edge, I hope. Yeah. Then in about, the year 2000, 2001, I was asked to start a creative writing conservatory at the Orange County High School of the Arts. Mm-hmm. And I hoodwinked Tim into coming along to help. And I also was hired to teach at Chapman University, which is around the corner from our house in Orange. And I found myself with two jobs, basically, which really got in the way of production. Mm. Sold a number of short stories over the next couple of years, published a collection or two, wrote some screenplays that, as is true of most screenplays, especially if you don't really know how to write screenplays, didn't develop, but were kind of fun, I suppose. But it was quite a while before I got around to writing another novel. Mm-hmm. I was under contract to Ace Books, but fortunately, my editor there, Susan Allison, is a very, very nice person. She didn't actually lean on me too hard. But the next novel that I gave Ace was Knights of the Cornerstone, which came out about a year and a half ago. So mm-hmm. I was, oh boy, I don't know, 8 years, I guess, between novels.
Wow.
Yeah. Which was not necessarily a good thing. But on the other hand, this creative writing program now has 160 students, and they're brilliant, and 10 teachers, and it's pretty wonderful in that way, too. So,
oh, excellent.
So, you know, you can, yeah.
Wow, so now kids will be able to say that, you know, with the same awe I hold you having had friends with Philip K. Dick, could say, oh, James Blaylock, and that'd
yeah.
be awesome.
Yeah, they can. Yes. I don't know. That and a nickel, I guess.
All right. Let us open to some questions from this audience.
And Chris, if you could repeat the questions into the microphone when you get them.
All right. This might not be a problem yet.
Not much repeating going on.
Hmm? Yes. So what kind of experiences do you like to draw on for your writing pieces?
You know, I love that question just because I'm pretty much the same way. I don't know, certain sorts of writers, I suppose, depend on their own lives to draw material from. And I think from, even in my early fantasies, The Elfin Ship and The Disappearing Dwarf, I can tell you where a lot of the stuff came from in my own life. Generally, though, in my third novel, The Digging Leviathan, the main character, one of the main characters, who's a 15-year-old boy, is crazy for Edgar Rice Burroughs paperbacks with Roy Crankle and Frazetta illustrations. And I think over the course of the novel, they actually turn out to have a bigger effect on the plot and on the characters than I would have thought possible when I was writing it. There's a lot of tide pool stuff, and I was a tropical fish hobbyist, and at one time, I thought I'd be a marine biologist because I kind of understood that I'd be able to just stay at the beach all the time. Turned out that I would have to take more science classes and that kind of. But I had aquariums full of tide pool critters and stuff that have sort of figured into. I think that it's probably a restful book of mine when there's not an aquarium someplace in it, and whatever's in the aquarium had been in one of my aquariums at one time or another. Small things like that, probably. There's only one time that I actually used a story wholesale, something that came up in my own life that had plot to it. But the characters, strangely, have nothing to do with me at all. Whereas the more fantastic characters probably do have more to do with me, I suppose. Mm-hmm. In the Last Coin, lots of the scenes in the Last Coin are taken from my life in one way or another. So many that now people confusedly think that I did the stuff that my crazy character did in there, when in fact I did not. Yeah, that's one of the hazards, I think, of mixing your own life into things.
Mm, yes. Chip?
What is the worst piece of advice you've gotten about writing?
What is the worst piece of advice you've gotten about writing? I can top it.
Well, you know, I don't know. When I teach creative writing, I tend not to use textbooks because I find that I don't really agree with most of what goes on in textbooks. I simply compile a packet of my favorite stories, and we read those and chat about those, which maybe gives the students a kind of a twisted understanding of the craft. Lots of the advice that you get in textbooks about plotting and how stories work is pretty bad advice, it seems to me. Although it might seem like bad advice to me simply because I don't write like that, and perhaps if I did write like that, it would seem like good advice. It's kind of hard to say. One of the things that I believe was bad advice came from, to get back to the story we started with, Lester Del Rey's telling me why I should not write The Digging Leviathan, for example, which is one of my favorite of my novels also. And I believe if I hadn't written that, I wouldn't have written The Last Coin later on. I suppose it's always bad advice when somebody tells you what you ought not to write, when in fact that's what you very much want to write at the time. I think you really have to go your own way, which is something I like to tell students too. It horrifies me to think that any student would listen to me avidly enough to be persuaded not to do something that he or she really was inclined to do, especially because very often we've got to do those things just to figure out what we are not as writers, you know. Mm-hmm. So,
yes, the worst advice I ever got was actually from Paul Anderson, was read more Hemingway, write like that.
Oh.
Okay, we might have time for one more question. And I'll ask it then. Fine, be that way. What else would you like our wonderful listeners and the people in this audience and the aliens that will be hearing this when we broadcast it out into the ether, what would you like them to know?
Wow, what would I like them to know? I have no idea on earth what I'd like them to know. I suppose the only, this comes in my mind, it's apropos of absolutely nothing we've said and probably nothing that the audience cares about, but some of my favorite science fiction novels that, you know, predicate a this, that, or the other future. The future, let's say, of William Gibson's novels. I love William Gibson's work. Neuromancer was a great book. One of the things that I don't quite like about them is that it's very seldom we see a future that involves regular folks sitting around having regular dinners and drinking regular beers and cracking regular jokes and going off to, you know, maybe a little bit of that in Phil Dick or something.
Yeah.
But I far futures have to include people like me for me to be vitally interested in the nature of the far future. I hope that makes some kind of sense.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, we could have another panel on that right now.
Yeah, and I think a lot of my books are about people I know, at least in terms of their sensibilities. Mm-hmm. It keeps the... another of my favorite of my own books, this is the last one I'm going to claim is a favorite of mine, is a thing called All the Bells on Earth, which mm-hmm. is, I think it's spirit related to The Last Coin. It's set in my own neighborhood. It's very claustrophobic. The characters never get out of the neighborhood. There's spontaneous human combustion going on and murder and all kinds of other great things. That was, I think, as fun for me to write as any other book I've ever written, just because I pretty much knew every character in it. And they're all small-time people struggling really hard to maintain some sense of dignity and self-worth and sense of morality, I suppose, mm-hmm. doing just day-to-day things,
yeah.
which I think defines my work as much as anything else. Mm-hmm.
That's like the perfect wrap-up.
Good.
Yeah, you did it. Ladies and gentlemen, please, Mr. James Blaylock.
Thank you. This is fun. Great.